We'll get started in just a minute, everyone. And just a quick announcement, tonight's class is class number 5 of 6. So next Monday will be the last class for All About Karma. And then we'll take a couple week break. Let me just make sure I'm telling you right. Yeah, 2 week break, and then we'll start up again on Monday, November 8th. For Refuge in the Three Jewels with Robbie Watkins. Does anyone have any?
Exciting.
Yes. Woo-hoo. Anyone have any questions before we get started? All right. So Don, it looks like whenever you're ready.
Okay.
Begin.
All right, so let's start out with a little meditation, and so sit up in your chair, cushion, wherever you're meditating tonight. I don't think, you know, hardly ever see people on cushions anymore. Is anybody sitting on a cushion? Nah, I didn't think so. Anyway, it's okay. There we go. All right. So, sorry. I need to go see a doctor for allergies. All right. So, let's start out with about 10 minutes or so of mindfulness of the breath. Most people know how to do this practice. It's a good settling practice for us and for our minds. And so sit up straight and get comfortable in a comfortable position. If you're sitting in a chair, it's suggested that you keep your back straight, but it's sometimes hard to do. And just find a comfortable position. You know, ultimately, we would be able to take the meditative mind, and whether we're lying down, sitting, or standing, or walking, should always, you know, be able to carry that in mind. So their practices, a lot of practices in Buddhism, they have walking meditations, and, you know, of course, you know, meditations you can do lying down, and most of them are sitting up, though, because we need to be undistracted and present. So sit up straight and take a deep breath and exhale, and then take another deep breath and hold this one for a moment and exhale again. And imagine as you're exhaling, letting go of any negativity, any confusion, any of the residue of the day, just let it disappear. And then focus on the breath, wherever you can find it, wherever it's most readily accessible to you. So for many of us, we've sort of trained ourselves to recognize the sensation at the tip of the nose, the breath coming in or going out. But for some other people, it's the rising and falling of the abdomen. That's a big, I know in the Zen tradition, that's kind of important. They use that as a focal point. And otherwise, other people, just the whole experience of the body breathing. But as you do, as you breathe in and out, we're not going to count the breaths, but as you breathe in and out, just quietly note to yourself, like a little voice in your head, in, and then as you exhale, out, and in, and out, like that. So we'll go like that for a while. Thank you. And if you catch your mind wandering, you just simply bring it back to the sensation of breathing and begin again. It's kind of like the most important instruction in meditation is just simply begin again. Now, notice what your experience is when you get your mind focused. Now, for the next few minutes, I just want to let, still sitting in the meditation posture, but I want you to just let your mind go wherever it'll go. Just like ordinary daily life. If you want to, wherever your mind goes, you do whatever you do. Just allow it to wander wherever it wants to go. And then notice what that experience is like, and now bring the mind back again to the sensation of breathing. Just one breath at a time. And notice the difference in your experience of the focused versus the undisciplined, unfocused mind. Now, while we're in this kind of calm state of mind, let's set a motivation for the listening to the teachings and thinking about it and trying to process this information, see if it makes sense to us and so forth. We're going to set the bodhicitta motivation. So you can't just, you know, these bumper stickers that they used to, you know, just, they say like, just say no, or, you know, like, what do you mean with just say no, or just think about compassion, or just think about bodhicitta, set your motivation for bodhicitta. It doesn't work that way. Unless you're really evolved, it doesn't work that way. We have to take a couple of minutes to go through some sort of checking meditation, thinking about the different points that lead to a feeling of wanting to, you know, liberate every living being. And the method for us to accomplish that is to get our act together and develop our own good qualities and eliminate our faults and become a Buddha. So that's bodhicitta, but it's not something we can just snap into. We have to sort of work our way into it. And it's definitely based on love and compassion, and not just some sentimental feeling, but some sort of really deep felt sense of connection with universal living beings. And it just starts with the people that we live and work with. It has to start there. So we start out generating bodhicitta by thinking of what we call equanimity, where we imagine like friend, enemy, and stranger in front of us, somebody that we are attached to, we feel indifferent toward, and somebody we feel aversion toward. And it's good if you can bring to mind somebody specific and just notice how these labels are quite arbitrary based on something that has happened in the past. And they're very changeable. They're not permanent. And we can see how our attachment to the friend can cause problems, and certainly our aversion toward the enemy can cause lots of problems, and then just feeling indifferent toward the so-called strangers in the world is problematic as well, because what we want to do at the end of this is to feel like we want to get enlightened, and that just for us at this level, it may mean just I want to become a better person so I can make a difference. I can make a positive difference in a small way, in whatever small way I can. But from the bodhicitta perspective, it just doesn't exclude anyone. Doesn't exclude strangers, doesn't exclude the people we feel aversion towards. It's probably like the foundation of the whole meditation on bodhicitta is this equanimity practice. So just for a moment, think about it. Just for about a minute, think about these three categories of beings and let go of the attachment to the friend, the indifference to the stranger, and the aversion to the enemy, and just try to feel a sense of equanimity, seeing the impermanence of these different labels. They don't exist from their own side inherently. Even in past lives, these people have all been our family, our closest relatives, and so on. So this, they're not just, it's not just two-dimensional. And the next few meditations, we'll go very quickly here, are to develop love and compassion. This is not easy because it's just not our instinct to, you know, feel love toward people we don't know, or particularly people we don't like at the moment. So we reflect on the fact that all living beings have been family, have been like mothers in past lifetimes, and have been, you know, have, in fact, we think that way, that all sentient beings, all living beings, have at some point in past lifetimes been my mother, my father, my brother, my sister, been family. And then we particularly focus on the kindness of the mother, which is usually the one relationship where, you know, most selfless love in the family comes from our mother. And so we remember that the kindness of our mother of this life, and all the sacrifices that she made, and how much she loves us even to this day, if she's still alive. If you're lucky enough to have had a loving mother. And then imagine that all living beings have that same feeling toward you, and you want to develop that sense of love toward them. And then you want to develop the wish to repay the kindness of all these kind mother sentient beings who made huge sacrifices on your account in past lifetimes. And then we reflect on the faults of, well, on the equality of self and others. That we're all equally wanting to be happy, and equally want to avoid suffering. And it's said that it's like one of the most powerful ways to develop a sense of love is to reflect deeply on how similar we are. Different in so many ways, but it's a very fundamental way we're all alike in wanting to be happy and not wanting to suffer. And not just human beings, but animals and insects and the smallest sentient being that we can imagine always wants to avoid suffering and be happy. And so in this sort of really fundamental way, we're all exactly the same. You see, we're all equal in wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. And then we reflect on the false of selfish, self-cherishing, which is based on this mistake and perception of I, or self. Ignorance projects false sense of I. It's way beyond what is here, which is merely a body and mind, you know, that have come together to create this merely labeled I. And that's really who we are. But then we project, ignorance projects a false, inflated sense of I, and then we cling to that I, and that I is addicted to pleasure, and feels aversion toward any obstacle to our pleasure. So it's the false of self-cherishing selfishness. In Buddhism, it's like the ultimate demonic force, the devil incarnate, so to speak. And in a real way, that's, it's because it causes all the suffering for all the living beings, and it lives in our heart. It's just this mistaken sense of self. So we have to recognize the faults of following the selfish, self-cherishing mind, and recognizing the benefits of cherishing others. Lama Zopa says, for happiness, cherish others. So it's so simple. And then we exchange a sense of, and this is something we do, it's kind of a, it's just, it takes a little bit of thoughtfulness to do it, but we try to, and you know, we recognize that we have self-cherishing, and we imagine that we're exchanging the self-cherishing attitude for this new attitude of cherishing others. So now, everything that we do is motivated by the thought of cherishing others. Excuse me. So we exchange self-cherishing for the attitude of cherishing others. So now that we have a basis of love and compassion, and if we've done this meditation correctly, you know, we definitely feel closer to the strangers and the so-called enemies that we currently label people that, or beings that we label that way, and. So the definition of love in Buddhism is the wish that others could be happy and have the causes of happiness. And we have to connect with the meaning of those words, just not merely, you know, spout them off, but really connect with the meaning of the words. Everybody's like I am, wants to be happy, doesn't want to suffer, but is suffering. Everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. May they be happy and have the causes of happiness. And then the next step that follows that is, may they be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And we say that without having a sense of warmth and connection, when we see others suffering, compassion will not arise. So we have to have done this sort of contemplative setup to, so we feel connected and feel warmth. And then we see these beings suffering. We recollect not only are the ones that are near and dear, but other beings. Then compassion can arise in the mind. So may they be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And then the next step is sometimes called the attitude of universal responsibility, that I'm responsible, personally responsible for the happiness of all living beings. I'm going to take it on myself. I'm going to take on responsibility for guiding all living beings from whatever state of confusion and suffering and misery that they're currently experiencing, to full enlightenment. And as Lama says, and I'm going to do it by myself alone. It's not your job, it's my job. So it's kind of a completely radical idea. It's the attitude, though, that pervades the mind of a bodhisattva, a spiritual warrior who's, you know, basically embodies bodhicitta. Some person responsible for the happiness of all living beings. I'm going to guide them to full enlightenment by myself alone. An attitude of universal responsibility. And then realizing that we, you know, as much as we want to help, we don't have the ability yet. We don't have the skills to guide others, to help them in the most meaningful way, to know what to say in every situation that's going to be the most beneficial to that being's mind. We don't know that yet because we haven't really discovered it for ourselves. And so we have to become enlightened to do this. What we want to do in our heart of hearts, what we have to do is we have to develop ourselves. We have to seize every precious moment that we have from right now until we die. We have to seize every moment to plant seeds of virtue on our mind stream as much as possible and eliminate the faults as much as possible so that we can progress on this path to full enlightenment when we can truly be amazingly beneficial to all living beings. So it's like I aspire to take everyone to full enlightenment, and the method to do that is for me to get there too, to get my act together, purify my faults, develop my good qualities. So I must become enlightened in order to liberate all living beings. I must practice, you know, the three principles of the path, which are renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness, and the two levels of tantra, the generation and completion stage, to achieve full enlightenment. And have some faith that you have that potential. You have Buddha nature. You have Buddha potential. Uh-huh. We all do. So with that motivation, let's do our prayers, and then we'll jump back into some karmic stuff. So,
you want me to share the screen, Don?
Yeah, please.
With the prayers?
Yeah. Okay, so we'll start out with generating refuge in bodhicitta. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create, through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends or hatred for enemies. And then the mandala offering. Imagine, let's see, this ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Radna Mandala Kamni Yatayami. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Linda. All right, so how do we, I forget, you know, last week I got carried away and didn't put the homework up, but I'm sure there's plenty to think about. Any, we're coming down the home stretch of this class, right? Next week, if I'm alive, you know, never know. It's one of the, that's a kind of a Buddhist thing. I'll see you later if I'm alive. But anyway, so anything that's on your mind next week, I might be doing this class from California is what I was getting ready to say. I'm going to go visit my daughter who lives out in L.A. right now.
Don?
Yes.
I have a request. I'm so sorry I missed a class last week. I think that you were going to teach us about the Vajrasattva.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, because Tim had taught me this years ago, and it's so wonderful. I mean, I read every single word in the book from back to front. Every time when I do it, I was wondering, is there a possibility that someone could do a Vajrasattva retreat online? Because I really, really need complete instructions.
Mm-hmm. Linda, were you at that Vajrasattva retreat that I led out at that Avila Retreat Center? Were you there?
I was at one many, many, many years ago. And it was out at Roland's Farm.
Yeah.
And it was when I was brand new to Buddhism. So I was kind of like blown away a little bit because it was all new to me.
I love Vajrasattva practice. We did a retreat, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago at a Catholic retreat center, using this very text, and we took the whole weekend to do it. So yeah, it's a great practice. You know, I think doing it in person obviously is much better, but maybe that's not going to be an option for a while longer anyway. But yeah, I'd be, you know, I led that retreat. I'd like to do it again because I've been, you know, those kinds of things benefit me a lot. I think purification practice is where the money is, where it is right now at this point. Yeah, it's really important because we have a lot of negative karma. We just do, and it tortures us every day. We don't have any control. We're caught up in samsara, right? It's what happens in samsara. So we just have all this karma ripening, and we don't know. We can see it in our meditation practice. It's like we're sitting there, and it's like all of these thoughts and feelings and experiences are queuing up and ready to, you know, if you just focus on, just try to focus on your breath for a minute, all of a sudden, boom, off you go with some little dialogue or narrative about this or that. And you have no idea what's going to pop into your mind next. We have that much. That's how little control we have over our mind. We do have some control over how we respond to what comes into our mind. That's the, you know, karma, for example, is not predestination, so to speak. It, you know, we do have choice in the matter. But that is a karmic result too. And that's the result of our practices, the things that we do. So it's important to understand that we always have choice. We always are responsible and can take. And whatever arises, we do have an opportunity to either create another round of suffering for ourselves or to use that experience to break free from suffering. So, maybe next week we'll spend more time on that practice. Maybe that'll be the most of the class is doing Vajrasattva. But you have to memorize the 100-syllable mantra. Okay? That's everybody's homework. There's one other thing that I would recommend, and this happened back in the old days, back in the 90s when we were just getting started. We had there was a newsletter, and anyway, sometimes I would edit it and sometimes Robbie would, and just go back and forth. And one of the articles in the newsletter was the result of a teaching that we'd gotten at the center. It was about like keeping a little book of your commitments. And for example, you might take one of the 10 non-virtues for the next 10 days, take one of the 10 non-virtues. And for example, killing, you could write that down in the book. And then maybe two or three times during the day, you could, ideally, for example, for the Dalai Lama and I don't know what the Dalai Lama does, but I mean, I know that there are monks that six times a day, they do what's called a succession guru yoga, where they go through this visualization, recitation, but basically bring into mind their vows, the things that they promised to do and not to do. And so vows are so important in Buddhism because it helps us to not create negative karma when we get mindless. I got a vow not to kill. Oh, that's good to remember. Or I've taken a personal vow not to kill. So it's very interesting to write down, like, any time during the day a thought of harming another being comes to mind, or anything in that genre of harming others, and you would write it down. You could write that down in the book, because maybe day one is about avoiding killing. And then day two, you could write stealing. And any time a thought of taking or deceiving others and taking what's not freely given arises, you could write it down. And maybe, again, set up so maybe breakfast, lunch, and dinner you do this. And then at the end of the day, you review, your life, the kind of stuff that you've been thinking and the negativity that you've, whatever's come into your mind that's destructive, you purify it with Vajrasattva practice, for example. Anything else?
Don, there is a question. A student is asking if you can speak to the difference between Catholic confession and Vajrasattva practice.
I'm not Catholic, but I love the idea of confession. The Buddhist monks have, the Buddhist monks and nuns, they did confession at least, I think, on the new moon and full moon, on the 10th, or maybe it's the 10th to 25th, I can't, of the lunar calendar, but they do confession. So it's, but they're not confessing to another person. Actually, that's not true. Let me back up a minute. Sometimes it's helpful that if you have somebody there to confess to. I think that's one of the aspects of confession. Doesn't have to be, but it can be helpful from a Buddhist perspective to have another person there that you're confessing to. The most powerful person would be your guru. And then, Catholic confession, very similar, isn't it? Where you come to grips. Well, you wouldn't be going to confession unless you had something that you regretted and you've actually acknowledged that it was destructive and you feel in your heart of hearts that you regret it. And then you pick yourself up and you drive to the church and you go sit in that little box, I guess. At least, I don't know what they do, how they do it, but I know that I've seen it on TV that way. And then, you know, you confess to the priest, and then he gives you 100 Hail Marys to do, or maybe go to the food bank and work for a weekend and help the homeless people, or do whatever you do, those kinds of things. But I think it's really similar. I like, you know, I think some people think that's, I felt this way too before I understood what the four opponent powers are. But I can see some value in it, in people recognizing, acknowledging things that they've done that are harmful. And then, again, I think the word the Catholics like to use is contrition, which is I just poisoned myself. In Buddhism, we say, I just poisoned myself. But they feel a sense of contrition, and then they go confess it, and then they get the Hail Marys. But the most important part, remember, of the four opponent powers, remember what we said last time? The most important part?
Resolve.
Yeah. Promise not to do it again for a second or a minute or an hour or a couple of hours or a day or as long as you can. As long as you can keep your word, you vow not to do that again for some period of time. So that's like the most powerful part of it. Each part of it is powerful. But that's always been pointed out as the most important part. I don't know if that's in any Catholics out there, any boo cats, drop cats that sometimes people...
I grow up that, but I find the confession very, very hypocrite. You say in English hypocrite, because you go in the church, you go to the priest, you say, I did this. Okay, you can try this, okay, and then you start again. So this is my vision of my experience.
Did it help you any?
No. It was very... what the priest did was very, I feel very, what you say in English?
Guilt?
Paul, yes, a lot of guilt. Yes,
guilt?
A lot of guilt.
It's shame.
You are guilty and you have to do two, three Ave Maria and so on and so. And you feel guilt. It has nothing to do with be better, it's only guilt.
Yeah. So now what is it about Vajrasattva practice or just the four opponent powers that is, and what you understand about Buddhism, that, because what is guilt? Let's talk about the word guilt first. What is guilt? What does that mean?
As a Catholic, we were taught that guilt is the offense, having done something to offend God. And that's in the catechism.
So is that the definition of guilt? Is it, like, God says you're guilty, or you, it's something you feel, though, right? It's something, I feel guilt. We've all had that experience. I'm not Catholic, but Catholics don't have the corner on guilt, right? Whenever we do something, a lot of times we feel guilty. What is Buddhism's response to when we do something unskillful?
That's harmful state of mind, and we should regret what we did.
Yeah,
exactly. The resolution part, like you said, resolve.
Remember the example like we gave of drinking poison. Like these three guys. The first guy drinks the poison, drops dead. The second guy has just swallowed the poison and he's dead 2 seconds later. And the other guy has it in his mouth and he's just about ready to swallow it. And he goes, he's not feeling guilty. He's going, I regret that I have this poison in my mouth. It's going to kill me if I swallow it. So he spits it out, right? So that's a very much Buddhist perspective, and I think it's different. I think it's different. Also, I've also heard that, I don't know if this is fair or true, but that somehow guilt is kind of fostered a little bit by a notion of all powerful, somebody's outside of you who's judging you. And it could be, in a theistic perspective, I guess the word would be God, but unless, you know, I've been thinking about that for many years, and I think there might be something to it. I mean, you know, the judge says, you're guilty, okay? You're being judged in that way. Whereas in Buddhism, we're not being judged by anybody. It's very impersonal process called karma. As the Buddha said, if you do this, you get that. If you drink poison, you suffer, you die. You're not, so we, if we're, if we understand the Dharma, the Buddhist perspective, whenever we do anything that's destructive, self-destructive, or harming any other being, you know, it's really crucial to acknowledge it and then sincerely feel regret, you know, from our heart of hearts. Not guilt. Because just feeling guilty, just, it's kind of like self-flagellation. And that's not the point. It's to feel bad, and somehow that is purifying, you know, the problem because you felt bad. Well, I felt bad, so I guess I get to go, I can do whatever I want to now because I felt bad about it. That's not the point. Buddhism, you know, regret it, purify it, and resolve not to do it again. And that's similar, but maybe not the same. I mean, I know some Catholics that think confession's pretty cool, but it's different.
Anthony, can you take a question from Anthony, Don?
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Anthony.
It's not so much a question. It's more of kind of parroting what you said. Guilt comes from an external source, from a somehow transgressing some sort of law or some being or institution, so you can be guilty in the court of law. Whereas regret, and this is what I've learned from the different people that have taught me about, and especially like with Vajrasattva or purification practice, regret comes from reflecting on your actions and realizing they're unskillful or that you could have gone about it a better way. And confession in the religious sense, you're being absolved by an external, in that case, a god or some being. Whereas in Buddhism, given that we don't prescribe to any type of omnipotent being, your actions aren't being okayed or washed away by some other being external to you. It's about you coming to terms to what the actions that you've done, being honest about them and generating that regret and not wishing that you had not done what you have done. And then, like you said, resolving to abstain from such actions again in the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of on the other end of the spectrum from confession in that sense. Because yeah. Nobody can take that away from you. The only person that can really do anything about it is you yourself.
Yeah. I mean, Lama Yeshe, he taught a whole book on the Vajrasattva practice. And I remember one time hearing him talk about it. And he was talking about how much he loved Vajrasattva. He said, it's so cool because we use our mind, like we visualize Vajrasattva. We imbue Vajrasattva with this energy that we call Vajrasattva with the power to purify ourselves. See, he said, we use our mind to purify our mind. So it's kind of cool that way. And so, Vajrasattva practice has, and it always has to be, purification practice always has to be kind of, it always needs to include all of these four opponent powers. You know, the power of reliance, regret, the remedy, and the resolve not to do it again. Remember those four. Like, remember there's a bunch of lists. We are very proud of our lists in Buddhism, particularly Tibetan Buddhism. But those lists are good because it helps us. There are things that we need to know, so we need to memorize these things.
And it helps keep us organized. We do have another question. It's a comment followed by a question from another student. The question So we can develop the capacity to be observant of the moment when we are taking the poison and spit it out. So we could become our self-judge to stop ourselves before committing the action. That's yeah. with a question mark.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, when this may not be the perfect example, but it is a good, I mean, it works for me in the sense that you could be sitting in meditation, for example, and, well, let's say in real life, a situation arises and you're really practicing mindfulness and you see somebody that, that has done something that has harmed you in the past. And so immediately this comes into your mind, some sense of aversion or even hatred might arise in the mind. Okay. And you notice it. The second your mind turns in that direction, you are aware. You're through the power of your mindfulness. You're aware of it in that moment. And you reach into your Dharma medicine cabinet and you bring the Dharma medicine that works for you in that moment to help resolve, to not let your mind get carried away by this negative thought of aversion or hatred. And that maybe the medicine is you reflect on the impermanence of that thought feeling. Instead of being carried away from it, by you notice the, you recollect that it doesn't last, and you stay with the feeling and the thought, and you don't react to it, and slowly, just like the cloud, you know, passing in the sky, it disappears. They always disappear. Or maybe another, you know, if you're really good, you know, you could recollect emptiness, the self. Where is this, you know, the body's sitting, the mind is thinking, where's the self that hates this person? You know, there is no independent self that exists apart from this mind-body complex. So, you know, where's the I? If you're really good, you might go there. Another person, there in the medicine that works best for them is compassion. You go, oh, God, this is not good because this is going to hurt me. This, you know, I need to have a little bit of compassion for myself and this other person. When they harmed me, you know, they were under the influence of their own delusions. You know, they were completely consumed by their own delusions. That's why they acted that way. So I need to have compassion for myself, not allow myself to be carried away by this negative mind, and also reflecting on this other person's. They're like me. They want to be happy. They do stupid things. They harmed me. But, you know, they just created another realm for them. And they're just like I am. They're under the influence of all of their former past actions, negative ones, that is, that cause suffering. And have a little empathy or compassion. And I mean, compassion is a little bit different than empathy, maybe. But definitely having compassion is a great remedy for the negative mind. So anyway, in the moment, we get ready to swallow the poison, we catch ourselves, and we go to the Dharma medicine cabinet, whatever tools we've been able to realize or have some experience of, we bring that to the moment, and we solve our problem. And in that moment, Ajahn Buddhadasa, he said, I remember he's a Thai, he's from Thailand, he's a Theravada monk. He said, in the moment when you recognize that your mind has gone off and you bring Dharma wisdom to that moment and you solve your problem, you feel really clever. And that's a good, you rejoice in the fact that you didn't get swept away and create another round of misery for yourself. How cool is that? So, yeah, so that's good. It's good to think about that.
So kind of piggybacking on what you just said, another student has commented and or kind of asked, Dharma means to hold back? Yes?
Dharma means I mean, the Sanskrit word dharma means that which separates beings from suffering. So we say Buddha dharma. Where's my little Vajrasattva book? Oh, yeah. This is a little book of Buddha dharma. Okay? Now, if I had a medical text, I could say, well, there's a medical dharma text, because that holds beings, that can stop suffering too, maybe. Yeah, but that's the Sanskrit word dharma just means that. I mean, maybe somebody else has heard a different definition, but that's the one I'm aware of. Anybody? Yeah.
I've also heard that dharma can also just mean, with like the lowercase d, phenomena. You have the capital D, which is big dharma, like what you said, and then dharma can also be all the things that kind of exist.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, we talk about, yeah, I like that. I think I've heard that too. So I wanted to touch on something to keep my eye on the watch here. We got 28 minutes. I want to talk about something that I haven't really brought this up in the class, but two things I want to talk about before we end, and then we'll try to do a Vajrasattva practice. But one of them, I want to talk about, how things, looks real in Israel. So for example, you know, this example that I've heard before, this friend of mine was talking about it one time. He's talking, you know, he read the New York Times, and you could read that on the front page there'd be somebody who had, there's a picture of a guy in handcuffs. He's being carried away. He took a risk with his client's money, lost billions of dollars, was trying to, trying to escape to Taiwan or whatever, someplace, and to get away, and he got caught, and so they just shredded him in the newspaper. And you flip the other side of the next page over, there's somebody else who was clever and made a really, this other guy made a sort of a very risky decision that backfired and lost all this money for everybody. This other guy made another informed incision, but actually another risky decision, but somehow it made billions of dollars for everybody. Okay? So what happened? What happened there? I mean, both people did their due diligence. One guy lost everything. The other guy made billions of dollars for people. So why did that happen? How could that happen? And and every day it goes back and forth. Every day there are companies that made money that played, you know, that somehow they decided to be conservative and they made a lot of money. And another company decided to be really a risk taker and they made a lot of money. But then it can go back the other way. The next company was real conservative. They lost all their money. Another company was conservative and they made a lot of money. It's all random. It seems so random. So in life, things like, for example, you know, what you could say is if you're wealthy, you could say, well, you made a lot of good decisions that made you wealthy. But there are a lot of smart people out there that do due diligence, that try to make good decisions, and they don't accumulate wealth. They don't. So what's real is that this man or woman has wealth, this one doesn't. They both tried, but the results are quite different. If you go down beneath that, what is the real reason that this individual made money? What is the real reason? Karma. It's karma from past lifetimes. It's the same thing over here. We don't have any resources. We could do all the due diligence in the world we want to, but if we don't have the karma to have wealth and resources, we could go to school and get the greatest education and hang out with the smartest people ever, and we just blow it all because we don't have that karma. Another example would be like you crank a car. You put your key in the car in the ignition. You turn the ignition. You say, oh, the key, you would say the key cranked the car, right? Does that sound right? Well, it really cranked the car. Well, there's a lot of stuff between that key and the engine to crank it. But we could say, well, let's just say, for the sake of this example, the battery cranked the automobile. But ordinarily, we say the key cranked it, right? So the key is what looks real. What is real is everything that the key, you know, ignites, literally, starts this whole chain of reaction. There's all kinds of gadgets in the car that make it crank up and so forth, but we're focusing on the battery. We say, so what looks real is the key, but what is real is the battery. So you can brush your teeth all day long. People brush their teeth. Everybody brushes their teeth once or twice a day, right? And how many people have ever had cavities? I mean, I have. We've all had, probably everybody's been to the dentist and had cavities. Now, there's some people that don't brush their teeth and they don't get cavities. There are people that brush their teeth every day and their mouth is a wreck. So is brushing your teeth the cause of getting cavities or not giving cavities? No. That's what looks real. What is real is the karma. That's what's underneath the dashboard. So whatever we have in our lives, that's what looks real. But the real underlying cause of it is karma. So if we want something, we have to create karma for it. You know, we have to do the work, practice virtue, plant those seeds. If we want to be wealthy, then we have to practice generosity. If we want to be respected and people to listen to us, we need to keep our mouth shut and speak truthfully when we do speak and speak, you know, with sincerity. And it's, you know, we can take a million situations, you know, but on the surface, things have an appearance of what looks real, but what's ultimately causing all of our experiences is our karma. Is that making any sense? So this is a big deal. Because we all have things that we want. Like we want good relationships. Okay? Well, let's say we want a new, you know, like a really great partner. You know, whatever. We want a partner in life. To, you know, to share our experiences with and love and adore and somebody who's got our back and all that. So, you know, and you don't have one. Okay, so you, what do you need to do? I mean, do you go to bars? Do you get on like 10 or 15 different dating sites and try to find as many people as you can? I mean, what's the cause of this? Is it being in the right place at the right time? That's what it looks real. I guess you'd say I have a bunch of patients that have found their spouses on different dating sites. And that's, you know, they say, oh, yeah, whatever, blah, 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 match.com is like the one. That's so good. That's what it looks like caused the relationship to happen. But what ultimately caused the relationship to happen was a karmic connection. And then, and if it's a good, it could be a bad relationship. It could turn out to be really bad or really good. But all of that's karma. That's what's under the dashboard. And so for all the things that we want in life, we can look and try to find out what the karmic causes are. And generally speaking, it's practicing the 10, you know, avoiding the 10 non-virtues and practicing their opposites is going to create the karma for us to have everything we could ever want and need. It sounds easy, but it's not. Right? Any comments, thoughts about that? Yeah, I mean, there's some people that are extreme, you know, there's some people that make really, you know, they're not very bright people, you know, in a worldly sense, but are very extremely successful in their business life. And then there's some people that are really, really smart, but they just can't quite get it together. They can't get over the next hump because they haven't created karmic causes for monetary success. And we're talking about, in this, ultimately, we want spiritual success because, you know, in our, again, what we really want is, I'd say we really want to be satisfied. We want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. It's really pretty easy. And so we have to create those causes. They just won't happen. So then the other point I wanted to talk about, any thoughts about this or comments before?
We have one student who commented, sometimes it is also teaching us to not be associated with negative people.
Yes. Yeah. And anytime we experience a negativity, where did it come from? Anytime we suffer, where did it come from? If somebody embarrasses me in front of 100 people, where did it come from? What looks real is that this person is mean and hateful and uncaring. But what is real is that I did this to him or her in the past, and I've done it to other people in little ways and maybe big ways, and I need to be extremely vigilant to not do that anymore, not even to have thoughts about it. So anytime we have obstacles to come in our lives, we can learn from those. We can look at the karmic causes of them. If somebody rips you off and steals from you, you know, looks like they stole from you, but the karmic causes, we stole in the past life or in the past in this life, and now it's coming back to us. And so we need to practice impeccable integrity, you know, when it comes to material things. Things that can be taken from us. We have to be very, very careful. So we can learn. We need to use all of these experiences that cause us to suffer are opportunities for us to learn what not to do and what to be doing. It's very important to take a look at when things bad happen and not blame somebody else, but go look and find out what the karmic cause is. And promise yourself you're not going to do that again, no matter what it takes. You're going to avoid that action. All right, so I want to get on to the other point here before I run out of time. So this I talked about this in the first class and a little bit every class probably, but I talk about the marriage of karma and emptiness, and I think it's still. You know, emptiness and karma are sort of intertwined. And most people would, you know, if you said, most people would say, like, teachings on emptiness, oh, the profound emptiness, that's how you stop suffering, that's how you achieve nirvana, that's like the most important teaching in Buddhism. But as the Dalai Lama said, and as was said early in, you know, in the video that we had in the first night, the most important teaching in all of Buddhism is on karma. I mean, we don't get this, nothing, it doesn't really come together for us in our life. We just continue to create more and more obstacles where if we understand karma and how it works, we can begin to clean up our karmic messes and then start planting the seeds for a beautiful garden, not a garden full of weeds, which we none of us want. So it's really important to recognize For example, again, that from the point of view of emptiness, there is nothing that exists independent of my mind labeling it. There is nothing out there that exists independent of my mind labeling it. There's nothing that exists from its own side so that everybody would see it the same way. If it existed from its own side, every sentient being, a dog, would see this as a magic marker, and I see it as a magic marker, and a worm, which everybody would see it, but it's the mind that labels it. A dog would chew on it, but I would use it to underline things or highlight things. Perception is everything. Everything exists in dependence upon a mind labeling. Remember the aspects of dependent arising. Everything arises, and this is karma, and this is a proof of emptiness, by the way. It proves that nothing exists out there independent of my mind labeling. So there's nothing that exists inherently. Everything exists in dependence upon causes and conditions. That's karma. Everything exists in dependence upon its parts. Everything is made up of atoms and parts that come together, and then we label it such and such. And everything exists, and this is the most subtle and the most difficult one to see, but it exists in dependence upon a mind that labels it. So when we go out, as Lama, if you were there Sunday when Geshe was talking, he was talking about the object of refutation, which is basically we think that there's something out there that's real, and we believe it, and we cling to the notion that there's something out there that's really a mean person out there, or a nice person out there, or a beautiful place, or whatever it is. We think it's really out there. And when we go and look for that thing that appears to exist inherently, independently, in and of itself, it cannot be found. It's as if things don't exist at all, but they do. But when you go to look for it, what you find is space. You find nothing. You don't find an inherently existent self or I. We don't find that. And so in meditation, basically when you look for the self, you look in the body, can't find it there. You look in your mind, you can't find it there. And then you're left with this profound sense of emptiness. It's not there. What I believed was there is not there. And then when you get that sense that it's not there, it's not there, it's not there, it's not there, you look and you see that we are void of that false sense of self. We're empty of that false sense of self. We hold on to that experience. But it's as if there's nothing out there that exists independent of a mind that labels it. Where do the labels come from, everybody? Where do they come from? Where do they come from?
Our mind.
Yeah, our mind. And where do the labels, what's underneath the dashboard? Where are they coming
from? Karma.
Yes, they're coming from our own former actions. Two-thirds of the Buddhist teachings are on ethics. There's a good reason why Buddhism emphasizes ethics, because ethics is the cause of happiness, karmically speaking. If we behave in ways that we don't harm ourselves and others, we practice virtue. We plant seeds of virtue on our mental continuum. And those seeds ripen. As those seeds ripen, how do they ripen? When we truly have planted seeds of virtue, how do they ripen? In us being happy, in our life working, in things going well for us. And when we suffer, it's the fruit of past actions. So what we want is less suffering, more happiness. And now we know. It's like I said, nothing exists independent of the mind labeling it. And each of these frames of, I mean, we're talking about visual consciousness, but there's tactile consciousness, mental consciousness, so on. I mean, we got auditory, visual, gustatory, tactile, you know, you name it. But, and there's also mental consciousness. You know, everything that we experience is basically karmic seeds ripening. The cooperative conditions have come together for those seeds to ripen, and we have that experience. And if we want to be forced, because you can't change, you cannot in 100 years tell me that you can tell that this is a horse or a car. No, it's a magic marker. You can call it a horse or a car you want to. You can label it any way you want to, but you know that it looks like it and it functions as a highlighter. So our mind labels that. How do we know that? Because of past seeds that were planted when we learned what this thing did the first time we learned about it. Okay, those seeds are always ripening. They're always, and they force us. This is the kind of interesting part. Literally, we are forced to have the life that we have based on our karmic projections. You know, we are forced right in the moment. If you're miserable, that's your karma forcing you to see yourself that way. It's not God or Buddha. It's just our karma ripening, causing us to have a karmic projection of being miserable. If we're happy, we're forced literally by our karmic projections to see ourselves as happy. If we want to have the karmic projection of achieving nirvana, which is complete freedom from suffering, or Buddhahood, which is, you know, the next step up, which is not only freedom from suffering, but actually able to really, truly benefit other beings and guide them to from whatever state of confusion they're in, to the supreme happiness. To be able to do that, we have got to create the causes for it. If we want to have that projection in our lives where we're a Buddha, then we have to use every precious moment to plant those seeds of virtue and purify the negative ones. And remember what the four laws of karma? Got to have this down, people. Got to have this down. This is important. This is good stuff. So what are the first one is karma's definite, right? So positive actions result in happiness. Negative actions, actions motivated by self-cherishing, selfishness, always, actions motivated by greed, hatred, and ignorance, always result in suffering. Actions motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, non-ignorance always result in happiness. So important. This is what bodhicitta is so important, because our motivation is the chief determinant of whether an action is virtuous or non-virtuous. You got that? Our motivation is the principal determinant. And in fact, in the bodhisattva vows, this will blow your mind. In the bodhisattva vows, it's said that if you are really purely motivated by compassion and wisdom, and you know in your heart of hearts that you are, that you can break all the other vows. If that's what you have to do in a particular situation, that's how important our motivation is. And to even know what our motivation is hard to do. Because almost always is selfishness. And so we use these vows, these 10 non-virtues, things like that, as guides to protect our mind as we grow spiritually. We use some, we try to take vows, as many as we can, maybe just one or two. You can, ideally, you take them in front of a teacher, but you could take them in front of an image of a holy being, if that works for you. But vows are really important. And so this is how I know we're running out of time, but this is how karma and emptiness come together, because things are empty of any inherent existence out there independent of our mind, and our mind is literally projecting our reality. It's as if there's a blank screen out there, and our mind projects our experience called my life, and the projector, the film and the projector and the frames of the film are karma planted in the past, in this life or some former lifetime, and the frames that force us to see ourselves as happy are called, those frames were created by virtuous actions, and the frames that force us to see ourselves as suffering, those frames were created by non-virtue. So that's why it's an enlightened self-interest to be kind, be compassionate, be a good person, do the right thing. It just, because otherwise, we're screwing ourselves over. We're shooting ourselves in the foot. It's crazy. So virtue is, so watching your karma is kind of the biggest job we might have from now and the rest of this lifetime, is just watching our karma, every aspect as much as possible. Question about that?
If anyone has a question, just go ahead and unmute and you can ask it. And if anyone that's watching on YouTube has a question, you can certainly leave that in the chat and I'll relay it. Julie, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just talking about karma, like last week I dreamed I saw all of my past lives swarming out of this like little village. I think it was like in Italy. Everything was in black and white. Everybody was definitely dead, but they were still alive, walking. It was really weird. So what does karma and the types of dreams we have? I had a dream about Geshe-la and my husband were standing 20 feet away from me, and they were both doing this, like, this is the way, both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so
dreams are definitely karma. I mean, that's what we have in our, you know, and the dream mind is a subtler level of mind than obviously the gross consciousness, right? And so, you know, dreams are just karmic projections too. I mean, there's a whole practice in the tantric teachings called dream yoga, where you train yourself to be able to, you know, see yourself in a dream without identifying with yourself, and literally, you know, guiding your mind. But that's another day. I don't know it. I don't understand it myself, but I've read a little bit about it. But yeah, so dreams are a karma ripening as well. And in fact, if a monk, or I mean, this is part of the teachings too. If you have a really negative dream, you should try to purify the karma, because that was your mind. So if you have a monk or a nun, let's say, for example, who has a lustful dream or something like that, and they have a vow of celibacy, they would, if they were sincere about their vow, they would want to purify that when they became aware of it at some point in the future. So yeah, that's, yeah, your mind is creating your dreams. I don't happen, when I was a kid, I could fly, I could go all over the place. I don't even remember my dreams much anymore, but some people are really good at it. I just don't happen to be one of them.
Yeah, and another thing is, I had started doing a lot of like the 4-point analysis and like clear light. And when I was at the beach, I was doing a specific meditation, and this phrase keeps coming up, there is no coming and going. And so that particular weekend, Geshe Sangpo had the circumambulation on Saturday, so I left and came back. And the pamphlet they handed out at this practice, the first line said, there's no coming and going. I think I should have kept that one, took it home with me.
Well, it sounds very much like the Heart Sutra, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's no enlightenment. Well, that, you know, in Lama Zopa's dedication, which I read last week, you know, there's no enlightenment. There's like, you know, what he's talking about, there's no inherently existent enlightenment that exists independent of our mind labeling it. There's no bodhisattva. There's no path. There's no virtue. There's no, it all depends upon us. We're, our mind is creating our experience completely. Lama Zopa says there is, I hate to say this and then say goodnight, but he says there is something out there, you might say, but it's so subtle, because even when you go to look for something out there, you can't find it. But obviously things function, so things do exist. But Buddhism is very adamant about, yes, things do exist. We do exist, but not the way we think. And things out there don't exist the way we think they exist. In fact, they exist the opposite of the way we think they exist. We think they exist out there, and in fact, they're the projection. They're our karmic projection. It depends on our mind labeling for its very existence. So that's enough for tonight. But let's, so next week, I don't know where I'll be, but I'll tune in, let's see, 3 hours difference on the West Coast, so 4 o'clock. So I'll tune in and we'll go over Vajrasattva, okay? We'll do this practice and we'll review, the main points that I want you to remember, which I've reviewed them again tonight, but I want to go over those. I think the main things are, you know, the 10 non-virtuous actions, you know, the 4 laws of karma, you know, the 4 opponent powers. Those are things that you really, really need to know, to bring, you know, to memorize and have on our fingertip and be mindful of all the time as much as possible. So let's do the dedication verses now. Is it time? Are you there? Okay. All right. So, before we do the verses, I just want to say, thank you for your attention. Those of you who stuck it out and listened to me prattle on, but I did want to get these points, put them out there, just to give you some things to think about. I do think that, I'd like to do more meditation. Next week we will do more, meditation. On the important points that we talked about, particularly Vajrasattva. I can't go over the practice and teach it in depth because, you know, I'm not fully qualified, but I can teach it, enough that you can get some sense about it. But, it's important to do the meditation practices, not just hear these words, but to think about them and even meditate on them. That's really important. And I will put something out, give Linda something to put up for contemplation, think about this next week, some homework stuff. So we'll do the dedication verses. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid of a little with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may these never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Amen. All right. So very good. So lots of, so up until now, we planted not only tonight, but just, you know, through the whole class, those of you who have been here and listened to the teachings and have been trying to do your homework and think about this, you know, definitely, you know, many, many positive karmic seeds have been planted that will eventually ripen in our future happiness. And so, and again, it does take some faith in karma. It does take time to develop faith, but it, you know, the best way to develop faith in karma is to live our lives like it's the truth and just see what happens. Like, creatively align with, hey, this is the way things are and I'm going to live like this is the truth and just see what happens. And I don't think much bad will happen, and I think good things could happen. So thank you for your attention. Y'all have a good week.
Thank you, Don. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Linda.
Linda.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. See you next week.
Great.
Thank you.
Bye, Michael. Sue and everybody.
Bye, Julie.
Oh, I miss
you. Bye, Michael.
Bye, Linda.
Bye.
Bye.
So, Naga, can you hear me okay? Yeah, I can't hear you. Wow. I don't know what's going on. You can try, like, if you're on a computer. Are you on a computer? Yeah. On your keyboard, you know how there's volume controls? Can just make sure that that's on and turned up. I don't know. And when you signed in on Zoom, normally there's a little pop-up box that says join with audio. You did that? Yeah. I don't know, Naga. I don't know what Control-Alt-A is. Huh. No, Naga just doesn't have audio tonight. She was trying to figure it out. My daughter was offering to help. You know, these kids, they're so smart with technology. Well, I don't know what else to tell you. What else to do? Yeah, other than maybe you've done this starting and restarting.